take your protein pills. The Poisoned Electric Head Story.
Brain Coma. Chapter 29. Be in my video. Jane Kelly, a good friend of mine, contacted me to say she'd started a course called Women into Media, and that one of its objectives was to produce a pop video. The course participants were drawn from a spectrum of women, all turning to education for various reasons. Battered wives, divorcees, single mothers, bored housewives in need of a new direction. Women with issues and demons to exercise. What Jane's reasons for enrolling were unclear. But she was the only one amongst a small group who knew any bands. So when a subject for the video was sought, she suggested us. As usual, it took me some effort to sell the idea to the others, as the course wasn't called Young, Single, Nymphomaniac Women, Into Media and Threesomes. But I emphasised the promotional use of such a thing, and in the end they acquiesced. We were asked to submit a song, so we sent Creature Feature, a number that had started life as yet another Alien Comes to Earth theme with sample lyrics such as,
I'm intelligent, I'm just like Leonard Nimoy said. I'm a lizard, I've got eyes in the back of my head.
But it got changed into a song about Saddam Hussein with the lines,
I'm intelligent, an Arab with mega bread, with strange ideas running round in the back of my head.
I, for one, was happy with the first concept, it being more our style than indulging in clumsy politics. But P and AF were the ones singing it, so they got their way in the end. We also furnished the women with some photos to give them an idea of the band image, as a springboard for production values, and Jane kept me posted on what ideas and imagery were being bandied about by the ladies themselves. It soon emerged that some of them wanted a dour, moody, black and white affair, maybe as a cathartic expression of their own inner turmoil. But we prompted Jane to push for the opposite, strongly suggesting as many bright, pulsating, eye-jarring colours as possible. We were, after all, a psychedelic band. We were also aficionados of the videos of Devo, whose work veered towards tacky special effects to produce a deliberately cheap and comical look. And as basic blue screen technology was available for the project, we obtained some animated computer fractals to achieve a similar effect. Luckily, Jane's quite a formidable personality, and she had little trouble talking the others around to this more gaudy approach. And we ended up with a day-glow post-apocalyptic video game storyline. The video begins with four crucifixes on a hillside, desolate.
But not a punching bicycle in sight.
In front of an abandoned power station. As the song kicks in, four helmet-clad black figures appear on them, before breaking free and staggering downhill towards the camera. The action then cuts to a guy playing an arcade game, and we see that the movements of the four aliens, walking through ploughed fields, hanging from electric pylons, etc., are taking place on the console screen, intercut with hands frantically twisting a joystick and pressing buttons. When the chorus arrives, we're treated to P in cyber armour, gyrating epileptically over a throbbing fractal backdrop, before passing the baton to an equally bizarrely clad AF. The video continues in the same fashion, alternating between the four figures striding through desolate landscapes and mad psychedelic dancing choruses, and there are some hilarious sights along the way, including some blatantly unrealistic blue screen backgrounds, which are as convincing as interior car journey shots in old Cary Grant movies. The video went on to be Poisoned Electric Head's one and only national TV appearance, after I sent a copy to Channel 4's The Word for inclusion in their dreadful video section. I figured it was in with a chance, but amazingly, when it was shown, Mark Lamar drawled,
Every week we get loads of videos. The really, really bad ones make it onto First of the Worst. But I have in front of me, and you're about to have in front of you, the ones that aren't bad. These are the best of the rest.
So the ladies did us proud. Even after it had dawned on them on the second day of filming, just what kind of guys they were dealing with. We'd arranged to meet them and the camera crew in Lee for the opening scene, a location chosen for its bleak landscape and plethora of disused mines. So we got into costume at the dead fly. on the previous day's filming, we too late realised that our eyes and noses stood out under the black masks. So this time we blacked them out and added the smaller latex masks underneath as they had gauze eye sockets. Needing no instruments, we found we could travel to Lee by car, though the big masks were too high to wear inside it, so off they came. On arrival at the agreed meeting point, we parked up and waited, soon growing restless and bored. And that's when we spotted the corner shop. Well, it wouldn't do us any harm to have a quick beer before filming, and upon drawing the short straw to go in, I started removing my small latex mask. The others reacted with boos and catcalls, calling me a part-timer and saying how funny the shopkeeper would find it. So buckling under peer pressure, I left it on. They were all eager to know how he'd reacted when I returned 5 minutes later, armed with half a dozen cans, and I had to inform them that he hadn't exactly fell about laughing. As I recall, he didn't say much, just gave me my change, all the while staring at me in mute apoplexy. From his perspective, there was little to smile about, though soiling his trousers became an option when he saw the other masked men in the parked car opposite, coolly looking on as their buddy cased the joint for alarms and cameras. Where he found the resolve to press the emergency button under the counter, I'll never know, but I returned to the car none the wiser, thinking him merely a miserable get whose joie de vivre had long since withered away from prolonged exposure to smackheads and shoplifting school kids. Moments later, a car arrived containing the women, and they informed us that the camera crew were right behind, so why didn't we take the next left and wait opposite the field? We did as suggested, and it was while we sat there in blissful ignorance that 6 or 7 squad cars with a police helicopter for backup were scanning the area for armed robbers. What occurred next all seemed to happen fairly instantly. Suddenly, there were police cars in front, behind, and to our right, and they had us out of the car and up against the walls, sharpish. We did some fast talking as the women and crew arrived to corroborate our story, but the officer in charge was far from appeased. He spoke on his radio a moment before informing us that the chief super was coming out to the scene to bollock us personally. So there was little we could do other than get back in the car and wait for him to arrive. When he turned up, he bombarded us with a few questions along the "whose bright idea was this?" variety, interspersed with concerns for the shopkeeper's state of mind. Then stopped suddenly in mid-sentence, his face altering with rage and disbelief as he bellowed, "Take those fucking masks off when I'm talking to you!" Incredibly, up to that point, no one had asked us to do so, despite taking names and particulars. So en masse, we sheepishly peeled them off to reveal our ludicrous panda faces underneath. His face was a picture of spluttering indignation, instantly triggering a laughing fit that all the weight of the law could do little to stop. After all the threats to lock us up for the weekend and detailed reports of how much we'd cost the taxpayer, he asked what the name of the band was, then paused for a moment before roaring, Sergeant Major fashion, "Never fucking heard of you!" His parting word on the matter was that if we ever had the intention to enter the boundaries of Lee again, we had to phone the station in advance and warn them. Then, reluctantly, he let us go. The incident somehow made it into the Sun, where in true tabloid fashion they got all the facts wrong, mentioning me by name, but citing St. Helens and a Ronald Reagan mask. So with Channel 4 and the Sun involved, I guess it was a lot more media than either the women or the course organisers had bargained on. Chapter 30, The Dead Fly Dies. Having the Dead Fly Studios gave us a huge advantage over the other bands in the area. And from 1986 to 1992, we rehearsed there 3 nights a week unless out touring. We stored the gear there, did business from there, and recorded there. The only problem was it didn't belong to the band, but to 2 members of it. So every week, Bun and myself effectively lost £40 potential revenue from other customers. To offset this, we began charging the other guys £2 a week each as a kind of token appreciation tariff. But in 6 years, I can count on the fingers of one of Homer Simpson's hands the number of weeks they all actually coughed up. There was little we could do about it. We would have been cutting off our own noses, but it did get annoying when people turned up pissed or 2 hours late or not at all. It was all too easy to take the place for granted. And I remember only Phil voicing the fact that if we didn't have the fly, then in lots of ways we'd be absolutely screwed. And one night in 1992, that's what happened. I received a phone call early one Saturday morning telling me to get up there sharpish. Never an easy task at 6 a.m. But as the fire brigade were mentioned, I didn't dilly-dally. And on arrival, that's who was there to greet me. Firemen were trooping in and out with hoses and other equipment. And though the blaze had been quelled, I was struck by the intense heat still emanating from the walls as I pushed my way in. A fireman guided me up the choking, smoke-filled stone staircase, highlighting the areas to avoid where the floor had collapsed entirely, and I grimly made my way down the corridor to the office control room, expecting to find a black, smouldering void. I was relieved to discover that the office appeared relatively unravaged, though someone had inadvertently put an axe through the CD player. Surely not an isolated occurrence since the rise of Robbie Williams' solo career, I'll wager. Bun arrived soon after me, and once the firemen had departed, we undertook a grisly inventory of the scene. The damage seemed to have been mainly confined to the front end of the building, gutting the two practice rooms there. But smoke damage aside, the office and main storeroom seemed to have survived. There was naught to be done but ring all the bands with equipment stored and ask them to shift it. They reacted disgruntledly at this short-notice request on a Saturday morning, but it was amazing how quickly they galvanised their resources at the mention of the word fire, and the majority of them came within the hour. Most of them arrived in a state of shock, which was instantly amplified upon seeing the place, with the exception of the swamp stompers, who arrived with a crate of beer, which they deposited on the office floor before placing a conciliatory hand on our shoulders and wordlessly departing. They knew no words could heal, being on first-name terms themselves with the blues. We spent the rest of the day drinking and wisecracking to each new arrival, making increasingly black quips about the missed barbecues and the new open-plan decor we were trying out. But beneath the humour there was a deep, unsettling confusion. How were we going to emerge from this latest, most lamentable turn of events? Chapter 31. Jailhouse Brock. The Krusty Movement had become the next big thing, with the music press causing the record companies to come looking for a piece of the action. The Melody Maker even printed an A to Z of Krusty. Under P, it said, Poisoned Electric Head. They wore yellow boiler suits and fish masks and claimed to be in love with the whole world. Hardly accurate, but at least we got a mention. But the band who were getting all the attention were Back to the Planet. They wrote good reggae techno pop songs and had a foxy yet streetwise chick, Phil, as lead singer. They'd been trawling the Krusty Festival circuit for years, gaining a reputation as an authentic underground band, appearing at every makeshift stage, back of a truck and marquee along the way. Our gargantuan ego prevented us from heaping too much praise on anyone, but we kind of liked them. They were all right geezers. We all fancied their Phil, and I think their Phil fancied our Phil. In the media frenzy, they landed a major deal with EMI, made the cover of The Enemy, and embarked upon a national tour. Of course, we were jealous as hell, but fair play to them, they deserved it. Unusually, they were allowed to choose their own support band for the tour, and even more bizarrely, they chose us. We accepted, of course, if only to take our minds off losing the dead fly. A 20-something date tour of England and Scotland spread over a few weeks, which culminated in two nights at Windsor and began with an appearance at the 24-hour Technicolor Daydream, a Hawkwind extravaganza at Brixton Academy. This wasn't strictly part of the tour, but it was a great way to kick things off on a bill with Chumbawamba, Censor and the Aphex Twin. Christ, it was a great lineup and an even greater opportunity for us. The place was enormous, and it was bound to be rammed to the rafters. Wouldn't it be a pity if we somehow managed to balls it up? At this point, I have to say I'm not talking about nerves here, though like all bands, that's something you have to deal with, and a big crowd can really fuck with your head if you think about it too much. It's widely documented that John Lennon used to vomit before and after each live performance. AF used to vomit during the performance, but it was nothing to do with nerves, more the quantity of ale he'd consumed beforehand. Nor we used to get nervous when we didn't have any gigs, or if we didn't have any people coming into the gigs we did have. Big crowds were like 10 ball-breaking transit van expeditions crammed into one night, bring them on. And we weren't scared of sharing a bill with anyone. And I mean anyone. We had respect, but we were always confident of holding our own. The only band who ever put the wind up me was Cardiacs, because they were just so fucking good. Of course, there is a long list of people who would reduce me to a quivering wreck at the thought of sharing a stage with them. But it was never going to happen. A different genre or a different league. For example, now that I live in mainland Europe, if I ever even see Ralph Hooter or Florian Schneider from Kraftwerk, I know I'll just have a heart attack on the spot and die. Or fall into a coma at the very least. And it'll be no use getting my favourite pop artist to come to my bedside to come and talk to me, because they caused it in the first place. Since initially writing this, I did in fact get to meet Florian Schneider from Kraftwerk, and it was a slobbering mess I anticipated. I shook his hand, but anything after that was beyond me. I took solace in the fact that I was wearing a red shirt and black tie, and that hopefully my attire did the talking. Anyway, I'm digressing. Let's talk about Cardiacs again. Reading Festival 1986. We'd had the band together for about 6 months and we thought we were the cat's ass. Glastonbury that year had been my first and it was a blast, so Reading was a must. Even though it's just a glorified concert and not the complete other world immersion that Glastonbury's is. And we saw a lot of bands. For some reason we were wide awake on the Sunday morning. Probably because everything finishes about midnight. There's no music. Even ghetto blasters are frowned upon. It's like being in the Boy Scouts. No, actually it's worse. Boy Scouts are allowed to have campfires. So there was fat chance of a reggae sound system manned by fluorescent painted naked fire-eating druids keeping us up all hours. We looked in the programme and the first band on were Cardiacs, who looked like a right bunch with their pasty faces and maroon ABC cinema uniforms. It was bound to be a giggle if nothing else, right? Wrong. From the first note, you knew you were listening to something special. It was a very unique sound that seemed to come from under that stone you turned over in the garden when you were 4 years old and found a woodlouse. It was the sound of Rupert the Bear coming to life and sledging down the stairs in a biscuit tin. It made you feel like crying because Chippy Minton burnt his hand in Trumpton Bakery and because you were 100 years old and senile and everyone you'd ever met was stood around you in party hats blowing kazoos. I liked it. A lot. They were, and still are, the tightest band I've ever seen. Today's computer technology enables the creation of impossibly complex music. But this was just people with wood and wire and skins and circuits doing the impossible for real. Fate allowed us to play with Cardiacs on several occasions, and it was a privilege every time. And fate also made them not only record that seminal gig, but to release it a few years later. So in the tradition of this show, why don't we hear a track from the Cardiacs' Rude Bootleg, recorded at Reading 1986. This is Inner City Lining.
Me? To be the one with the wine tablets, but look, just the key pegs! Upon the shelf with the caps for the eggs, running for his life he begs! Please, mommy!
To me, I lie for ways to suggest.
Enough of these big bangs and chords on the guitar and on the organ.
But back to Brixton Academy. Our good friends in London, Bav and Jill, had offered the legendary hospitality if we wanted to come down a day earlier, Friday, in order to arrive at Brixton calm, composed and collected. We accepted their offer, and an away team of Pete, Al and AF went one better and headed down on Thursday just to get in the mood. No one knows how or when, but sometime between Thursday and Friday, the three of them were struck down by the stomach bug virus to end them all. When the rest of us arrived, they were in various states of incapacitation and were no better on the day of the gig. When it was time to leave, AF announced that he couldn't stand up and he was sitting this one out. P and Al had to be carried out into the van after one last visit to the loo to shit and vomit and vomit and shit. So, with one singer down and two walking wounded in the ranks, we arrived slightly less calm and collected than we had hoped. We unloaded the gear as P and Al unloaded their guts for the dozenth time, then picked up our all-areas passes and checked the running order. We were scheduled to appear at around 5 PM, so we alternately hung around the building or skulked in the van drinking and skinning up. Saucy Jack appeared with a colossal bag of whiz, and as it looked like being a long day, I decided to purchase some for after the show. Changeover times were as brief as they could be. A bit of a mad dash, but really well organised, so less painful than usual. Once the gear was set up, it was time to mask up and get on with it. P was in the loo vomiting, so we didn't do a vocal test, just a line check. We started the show with the usual instrumental intro. Al was in place and P was having his penultimate retch as Bill kicked into his Bobby Simpson beat. He was cutting it fine to get from the toilet to the mic in time for the first verse. 3, 2, 1, and no sign of him. Oh well, another instrumental. Whenever things went wrong, it was a hell of a job to A, see what was going on, and B, to communicate to each other what to do. The dome heads allowed for very little visibility and even less expression. Only the eyes showed through and they had to do all the talking. Everybody was wide-eyed, but not legless for once, engaging in retinal charades. Is it a book, a film, how many words, the whole thing? Add a few strobes and flashing lights and it's quite a party. Meanwhile, behind the mixing desk, Al had his own crisis to deal with and it wasn't what was coming out of the speakers. Under any other circumstances, you would drop everything and dash to the nearest loo. But he stood his ground. This was Brixton Academy after all, and there were no vocalists. He couldn't abandon the desk just because the bottom was falling out of his world and vice versa. It was traditional at the end of the first song to remove the big masks, revealing the smaller latex numbers underneath. This allowed for a bit more interaction visually and verbally, but there was fuck all that we could do other than carry on and hope for P to appear. What a mess. Even the most orchestrated of songs sound a bit lost and sparse when you take the vocals off, so God knows what the audience made of it. The only point where we felt remotely in control was the big space jam in the middle of What You're Gonna Be, Son. The whole sorry scene was over soon enough. I think Pete appeared in the last few minutes of the last song just to make it even more ridiculous. He'd been backstage convalescing, heard the music and thought it was the sound check. To say we were crestfallen was an understatement. I caught Bill's eye as we removed the equipment from the stage. He beckoned me over and said, "Well, I don't know about you, but I'm going to get absolutely fucking walloped." Now, was that ever a good idea? We dashed back to the van and waded into our stash of beer. We still had use of a dressing room for an hour or so, so this seemed a good place to relocate, snort some Go Faster Stripes and try to squeeze some fun out of the situation. We still had our backstage passes, and before long, we were on the prowl amongst the subterranean labyrinth of dressing rooms, looking for people to befriend and purloin drinks from. Once we'd exhausted our list of tenuous contemporaries, Back to the Planet, Censor, Osric Tentacles, etc., we ventured further afield, bravadoed to the hilt, no doubt annoying the fuck out of everyone. It had all the hallmarks of a big Leckyhead day out: chaos, confusion, no one in the same place at once for more than 10 seconds, but eventually we drew it to a close at about 4 AM. Saucy Jack didn't live far away, so he offered a night's comfort at his place as he could fit two people in his car. Strangely, nobody volunteered to join him, so I took him up on his offer and Al came along too. Beans on toast, cups of tea and a warm room awaited us. though I was still flying at the speed of sound and sleep was a long way off. The roads were fairly deserted, and I guess this is why we got pulled by a passing patrol car. He asked all the usual questions about how fast we were going. No, I wasn't speeding, officer. And where we'd been and where we were heading to. I suppose the 24-hour technical daydream wasn't the best of answers, but he seemed amiable enough. He even said, "You haven't got any drugs on you, have you, lads? I expect you've took them all by now." We shrugged and shuffled non-committedly. He then made a routine search of the car and unearthed a tiny blim of pot that somebody had hastily concealed under the passenger seat. No one wanted to admit ownership, probably out of embarrassment, and this became something of a bone of contention with the good officer. He wanted confession, repentance and grovelling, and another lost soul saved from the slippery slope by the righteous arm of the law for this minuscule, microscopic, barrel-scraping excuse of evidence. I cannot find the words to convey my contempt for this bored, brain-dead automaton prick and his power-trip mind games at 5 a.m. carrying on as if he'd apprehended the new Howard Marks. If no one was going to own up, then his hands were tied, and he radioed HQ for assistance. Two squad cars appeared, and within seconds so were ours, as we were handcuffed and thrown in the back of them. A white-knuckle ride followed, and not just because of the handcuffs, more the G-force speed the car was doing, eager to break the monotony of a quiet night in the station. Anything looks like a big fish in an empty net, so we were given the arch-criminal treatment all the way. On arrival, we were interrogated, searched. They even searched my dreadlocks, wading through them like Basil Fawlty, desperately searching for a duck à l'orange in a giant gâteau. Then processed and banged up, minus shoelaces. The cell was too brightly lit and too hot, which from a prison reformer's point of view leaves little to find fault with, but from my perspective was unbearable, and a restless, haunted half-sleep ensued. In the morning, we were released with a warning and met the others at the next venue, who positively pissed themselves at this ironic turn of events. So, this was the shape of things to come. It hadn't even been the first date of the tour, and a drug rap and time inside had already featured. God help us. And God help back to the planet. Take your protein pills. To be continued.
Poisoned electric head.